Let's read in Romans chapter 4. We'll be looking at verses 13 to 16. Let's just read verse 13 together. For the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. When the seminary wants to attract students or donors, we often put in our quarterly update a student who has come to us, studied with us, graduated, and then returned to their homes and are now ministering. And the reason we do that is because, well, we want to show you the best example of what the seminary does to encourage students and to encourage support. It's like here's a perfect example of what we're all about. And every institution, company does this to some extent or other. They try and find satisfied customers and put them in front of others to say, hey, this is what we're all about. Here's you want to know what we do and what we aim for, and how we do it, look at this person and their experience. And that's what we have really in Romans chapter 4. God is bringing before us his best example of someone being justified by faith. He's bringing before us really the best example of a believer. And it's quite surprising who he chooses, in a way. Because God's best example is Abraham. Moses obviously uses Abraham as an example, having written about him in Genesis, especially Genesis 12 through 15, where Abraham's faith is really focused on. So Moses uses him as an example. Jesus used Abraham as an example as well, by speaking of him as someone who looked down the road of history and saw the day of Christ coming and rejoiced in faith. And the Apostle Paul uses Abraham as a best example, both in Galatians and here in Romans. Why do I say it's a surprise? Why not Abraham? Well, it's a surprise to us, maybe looking at it down the road of history, because when we read about Abraham, we also read about a lot of failures, even moral failures. Is he your best example? And also because, of course, he's an Old Testament believer. And we might think, surely, if we're in the New Testament era, we should have a New Testament example. But no, we have an Old Testament believer. And in some ways, it was also surprising to the Jews of Paul's day, some of whom he was writing to. And especially surprising in the way that Paul presents Abraham in this chapter, because Paul is saying here, salvation is not connected to circumcision or to the law. And my best example of that is Abraham, because he was saved before he was circumcised, and he was saved before the law was published at Sinai. And the Jews hearing this would have thought, we're saved by being circumcised and keeping the law, and yet here's Abraham who was saved before he was circumcised and before the law. So it's a surprising example to us and to those Paul was originally writing to. But he is a wonderful example. He is the best example, otherwise God wouldn't use him. And he's the best example because he shows so clearly why God saves sinners through faith. Why does God choose to save through faith alone, as our Lord's day was bringing before us time and again? Why is it that the essence of the Christian faith is, I believe, full stop? Not I believe, plus I do this and that, or I don't do this or don't do that. It's I believe, I believe, I believe. Why does God save through faith? Abraham's our best example for four reasons, and we'll deal with them briefly because we have very little time today. The four reasons are summed up with four words: grace, guarantee, growth, and glory. Grace, guarantee, growth, and glory. First of all, grace. We read in verse 16, therefore, it is of faith that it might be by grace. Why does God choose to save by faith? So that it will all be about grace, not works. Now, children, grace is a word that we use a lot, and maybe we don't define it. We don't really tell you what it is sometimes. So maybe we can sum it up with this simple two-word phrase. It's a free gift. It's a free gift. It's not just a gift. It's a free gift. And not all gifts, in fact, not many gifts are free. Most gift-giving in this world is not free. They have strings attached. They have reasons behind them. For example, there's the reason of relationship. Why does a parent give a present to a child on their birthday? It's because they're related. Why might a politician, like we heard it in the debate the other night, like Donald Trump, give a gift of $2 million to Hillary Clinton? As he said himself, so she'll come to his wedding. He wants to create an obligation. That's not a free gift. That's a gift with a string attached. But grace is a free gift. There's no relationship that obliges the gift. And there's no obligation that conditions the gift. And the grace of salvation is seen in two ways. It's the grace, first of all, of doing nothing, and the grace, secondly, of gifted righteousness. Let me just illustrate both of these. First of all, the grace of doing nothing. That's what's highlighted here in this chapter. Grace is contrasted with the law. The grace of doing nothing is contrasted with the law of doing everything. He's seeing these Jews, he's seeing, well, people throughout the world, not just Jews, Hindus, Muslims, the lot. And what they're characterized by is doing to be saved. You ask any cult member, Jehovah's Witness, Mormon, you go and ask a Muslim or a Roman Catholic or a Hindu or even a pagan, what's their hope of being saved? And they'll give you a big list of all that they have to do or not do. That's the law of doing everything, in contrast to the grace of doing nothing. That sounds quite a gift, doesn't it? Children, maybe I can illustrate it like this. Imagine if your mum and dad came to you and said, I want to give you the best vacation you've ever had and you can ever have, ever. Let's think. What would that be? Maybe it might be, well, first of all, we'll stop off at Disneyland. And then maybe we'll go surfing in Hawaii. Then maybe we'll go snorkeling, scuba diving at the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Then maybe we'll ride some camels at the pyramids. And what else could we do? We could visit the Kremlin and see the amazing buildings there. Sample a bit of socialism, communism there. Just give you a bit of flavor of life as it's lived in different places. Maybe even, who knows, maybe we could at least make a start on climbing Everest. At least you can say you tried. I mean, add it all. Just dream the biggest dream you could ever dream about a vacation. And your mum and dad have said to you, this is yours. We'll do this next summer, but just a small condition. The yard. You've got to keep the yard completely weed-free for the next year. That's all. No weeds in the yard for a year. You do that, we're off. Well, you might think that's doable, surely, you know. So you go out first thing, straight away, and you get rid of all the weeds that you can possibly find, don't you? That's tough going, isn't it? You didn't realize there were so many. You pull them all out, you go to bed, but you're worried, aren't you? Did I get them all? Did I cover that corner? So you got up the next morning really, really early. In case Mum and Dad beats you to it, you get into the yard, you pick out a few more that might have appeared through the night. You rest a wee bit again, but it's on your mind all the time, through the day, as you're sitting in school. Hope there's nothing growing. So you rush back from work, from school, you get into the yard, and again, just make sure every corner is clear, and so it goes on. You can hardly sleep at night. You can hardly concentrate during the day with this focus, this obsession. There's one weed, we're not going. Well, it's a miserable life, isn't it, for that year, if you manage it even. And who can? What if you fall ill one day, you wonder? Or what if somebody comes in and plants some weeds when you're not looking? It's terrible, isn't it? Well, that's how many people are trying to be saved. By doing everything. By taking out all the weeds themselves and trying to make sure no more weeds grow. Yes, they see the promise of eternal life, of heaven, but they've got to keep the yard clean. They've got to keep their lives clean. They're trying to be saved by keeping the law. And what does the Apostle Paul tell us here? He says in verse 13, the promise that Abraham should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law of doing everything, but through the righteousness of faith, the righteousness which faith receives as a gift. For if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void and the promise made of none effect. It's saying these people are trying to be saved by the law. They might as well have no faith whatsoever. Faith is made void. It says the promise is of none effect. It's shredded. This wonderful promise might as well be in tatters or ashes. And there's no peace. Because we're told in verse 15, the law works wrath. The law has an impossible condition. And in contrast to it, there's the grace of doing nothing. The grace of doing nothing. It's as if these same parents came to you and said, look, there's two ways to get this grand world vacation. Way one is the way we've just described to you. You keep the yard clean. Or way two is you trust me to keep the yard clean. You trust me. I'll make sure there are no weeds. I'll be out there every day. I'll do everything that's needed. You don't need to do a thing. Do you believe your mum and dad? Do you trust them? What if they miss one? But that's what faith asks us to do. It says, trust Jesus. Trust his ability. Trust his commitment. Trust his doing. Trust his weeding. There are two ways to this inheritance. One is by law, that makes faith of no profit, that makes the promise of no point, and that gives no peace to the conscience. That's the way of doing everything. And then there's the way of grace, of trusting another to do everything for you. A faith that brings righteousness. a faith that brings perfection. There's the grace of doing nothing. Then there's the grace of a gifted righteousness. Again, let me try and illustrate that. Children, we have to confess. I confess, a minister, I often use terms like this, righteousness, and you really don't know what it means, do you? It's tough. That's a big word. It's not one you use in the yard or at school, is it? What does this mean? The righteousness of faith, or the righteousness that faith brings? Well, again, let me try and illustrate it. Imagine that you've got a big candy pile, and so does your big brother. But you've got such a sweet tooth that you eat through all that candy so quickly, it's soon gone. You've got nothing left. But you know where your brother, your big brother's candy pile is. And so what do? You, when he's not looking, you nip over there and you grab one or two, eat one or two. But it's never enough, is it? So you go and grab some more. And then some more, and then some more, and eventually big brother comes to his candy stash, and there's none left. And he goes to mum and dad, and he says, "Someone's stolen all my candy." And you're found out. What has to happen? Three things have to happen. Number one, you've got to be punished. Number two, you've got to replace the stolen candy. And number three, you want your own pile of candy back for yourself, don't you? Three things. And you look at that and say, that's impossible. To be punished is hard enough. To replace all these is next to impossible. And for me to rebuild my own pile, that's going to take me hundreds of Sundays worth of candy. Well, try and imagine a pile of righteousness, of good things, of worth, of value, of morality, of doing everything that's good. And it's not very big, is it? Your own pile. In fact, the more you look at it, the more it seems to disappear. And eventually you realize, I've got no pile at all of good works. In fact, you've been stealing from God as well. And eventually one day you're found out. And these three things have to happen. You have to be punished for stealing from God what he was due. You've got to give back everything that you owe him. And you've got to have a pile of righteousness yourself to please God with. And you can't do that. You can't bear the punishment. You can't replace what's taken. And you can't build up your pile. But that's what Jesus does. He takes the punishment. He repays what God was owed. And he gives you his righteousness, his goodness, his good works as your own. This is grace, isn't it? The grace not only of doing nothing, as opposed to trying to do everything, and the grace of a gifted righteousness. And he's saying, that's why God saves through faith, so that it might be by grace. I want to give the second and third just very briefly. The second reason he does it is to guarantee salvation. He says in verse 16, it's of faith that it might be by grace to the end, the promise might be sure to all the seed. Here's God got this great promise. Inherit the world. How can he make it sure? How can he guarantee it? Well, there's no hope of it being guaranteed if it is by our efforts, is it? I mean, what are you thinking of if you're thinking that it's all dependent on you? Well, you're going to bed each night and you're thinking these three things. You're thinking, one, have I done enough? Two, are there any flaws in what I've done? And third, will I be able to keep it up? Have I done enough? Are there any flaws in what I've done? And will I keep it up for the rest of my life? The way of works, religion, of law, has no guarantees, does it? Because who can answer for sure all these questions? I have done enough. There are no flaws. And the future is safe too. Not the person trying to be saved by doing his best or her best. But again, the person that's been saved by grace looks to Christ and says, He has done it all. There are no flaws, and His righteousness will endure. It will last. It's never going to diminish in value. He's never going to fail. Therefore, this guarantees salvation. It makes it sure. When it's all dependent on Him and not at all dependent on me, then, as the Apostle says here, the promise is sure to all the seed. The third reason God saves by faith is growth. Growth. He says in verse 16 that the promise might be sure to all the seed. All the children, not only to that which is of the law, that's speaking of the Jews, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham. In other words, of the non-Jews as well. Because Abraham was a pagan. He wasn't circumcised when he was saved. He didn't have the law when he was saved. And that's why he's such a great example of faith. The Jews claimed him as their own because they descended from him, but so could the non-Jews claim him as their own because he was saved before he was circumcised and before the Jewish law was given. And the apostle here is saying, God saves by grace because that's the best way to make salvation available and possible for every kind of person, whatever class, whatever condition, whatever culture, whatever capacity. Imagine if God had said, salvation's available only for the really disciplined. Well, that helps the Dutch, doesn't it? But it doesn't help cultures that are much more relaxed and don't really have any awareness of time or to-dos. Or what if God said, you know, only those who are really athletic. Well, that excludes the rest of us who don't have that kind of athleticism. What if God has said, well, it's only for those who have a certain height, and if you rise above that height, then it's not for you. Well, again, that excludes so many of the Germanic nations, the Norwegian nations, Scandinavian nations. Or if God has said, it's only black people, or only white people, or only English-speaking people, or only whatever. All of these would confine the church and limit its growth. Because it excludes so many. But he says, it's by grace because grace suits everyone. Grace suits everyone. Every kind of person can receive grace. No matter what age. No matter what intellectual capacity, no matter what physical strength, no matter what accomplishment or failures in the past, no matter what family background or lack of it, he says it's by grace that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to the Jew, but also to the Gentile who's the father of us all. So three reasons God saves by faith. Grace, guarantee, growth of the church, and lastly, glory. You look at verse 14, the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. Abraham was given a promise that he should be the heir of the world, and it's a promise that's given through those to those who also believe, like Abraham. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. What does that mean? What did it mean for Abraham to inherit the world? Well, it meant, first of all, that he would have sufficient in this world, that God would give him enough to live in this world. Secondly, it meant that God had made the world for him, especially, and for all believers. He worked all things together for good in this world. Everything in this world is working together for the good of all believers. Thirdly, it means that believers like Abraham would be able to enjoy the world in a way that unbelievers can't. The psalm says, a little that a righteous man is more and better far than is the wealth of many such as lewd and wicked are. He's saying it's better to be a believer with a little than a Donald Trump with $10 billion. Because the believer with a little has more pleasure and enjoyment in his little than Trump does with his trillions. Because the little that he has, he sees as a gift and as grace, as unearned and undeserved and just pure mercy from God. He sees God in everything, his fingerprints and his thought and his kindness is behind even the smallest crumb and the littlest drop. It also means that the believer knows he has a title to the new heavens and the new earth, even here. It goes around, each believer has a title, a legal title to the world. And one day we'll inherit it in the future. Title now, possession later. Imagine that. That means we can walk around this world and say, mine, that's mine, that's mine. All of it's mine. Christ says, all things are yours through me. It's got your name on it. The new heavens and the new earth, whatever they will look like. This earth reconstituted and joined together with heavenly glory. This is what Paul is holding out here to Abraham. Glory. The glory of a new heaven and a new earth. Wherein dwells righteousness. He says, you believers now, it's yours. Legally. And soon will be yours experientially. It secures glory. Faith secures glory. And that's where I conclude. Really, we might have somewhere in this world a document in someone's safe with our name on it. And at the top it says, will. Maybe a mother, a father, a rich uncle or aunt somewhere. And they put your name on this document and said, when I die, this is their inheritance. That's good. I think we would all like that. But what Paul is teaching us here is that there are documents in heaven, as it were. Everyone has an inheritance in the vault of heaven. Every single person's name is on a document in a vault in heaven. And beside every name, there's one word. It's a choice of two, but you can only have one. Here are all the believers' names, all their documents. You flick through them all, and it says in their inheritance, the world. World, 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 world. Heir of the world. But then we go through the unbelievers and flick through, and every single inheritance says this: wrath, wrath, wrath. We're told in verse 15, the law works wrath. That's it. World or wrath, that's your inheritance. It's one or the other. And there's nothing more urgent in life than that you ensure your document says world and not wrath. That's more important than anything else you can do, today, tomorrow, or any other day. That should be the number one thing on your list of priorities. Am I an heir of the world, or am I an heir of wrath? What's ahead of me? The world, the new heavens, the new earth, mine to explore and enjoy and delight in with Christ, or wrath, anger, fury, forever. There's one thing that separates these two vaults, and it's faith. Faith transfers your document from wrath to world. That's why Paul here says through Abraham, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. Amen. Let's